This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield approval. If you qualify and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Jury selection in Paul Manafort's second trial this week, and over the weekend, more denials from top White House officials about who wrote that anonymous New York Times op-ed. But more Republicans are wondering what effect chaos from the White House will have on the midterm elections. Democrats may have energy on the ground, but the GOP has the campaign cash, so we're going to talk about all of that and more. This hour on Point, the weekend that was, and the week ahead in the news. You can join us on air or online. What are you paying attention to? The soap opera, as one Republican senator called it this weekend in the White House. Did you attend any midterm campaign rallies this weekend? And what do you see coming ahead? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me today is Josh Gerstein. He's senior White House reporter for Politico. He also covers justice and national security. Josh, welcome to you.
Hey, Meghna, great to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us is Weijia Jiang. She's White House correspondent for CBS News. Weijia, it's good to have you.
Thank you, Meghna. Great to be here.
And with us as well is Aaron Blake, senior political reporter at The Washington Post. Aaron, good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we've got kind of a power lineup here to help us make sense of the week in the news that's going to be coming up. But let's just start off with what we heard over the weekend on Sunday, in particular on the Sunday talk shows, because Vice President Pence went on two Sunday talk shows to denounce the anonymous author of that New York Times op-ed, again, published anonymously by a senior White House official. The vice president also denied that he was the official. Here he is speaking with Fox News Sunday's Chris Wallace.
Should all top officials take a lie detector test, and would you agree to take one?
I would agree to take it in a heartbeat and would submit to any review the administration
The administration should do that?
Well, that'd be a decision for the president.
That was Vice President Mike Pence on Fox News. Well, over at NBC, presidential adviser Kellyanne Conway was on Meet the Press, and she told Chuck Todd that anonymous op-ed has had an impact on morale inside the White House.
Do you trust everybody you work with right now?
Yes, I do. And I'll tell you what happened this week. The team tightened up even more because of all this. Folks who don't even work together because they deal in different portfolios, different issues, folks who don't know each other that well, some new, some who have been around as an unbroken thread from the campaign like me. We are tighter this week because we are so joined in our outrage.
Weijia Jiang, let me start with you. I mean, Kellyanne Conway there saying that perhaps White House staff is more close-knit because of this, but yet the chaos seems to continue to have ripple effects.
Well, I think perhaps they are feeling more exposed than ever, but I don't think that any camaraderie that they had surrounding this is new, because the content of both what was in Bob Woodward's book as well as the op-ed in the New York Times is not new. They dropped back to back during the same week, but obviously, you know, those reporters had been curating the content, had been conducting dozens and dozens of interviews, and have an understanding deeply of the administration. And so, this description that Kellyanne Conway has put out there to sort of deflect the chaos is expected.
Right.
But again, what they are experiencing together as staffers is not new. So many media outlets, of course, CBS News included, have been reporting since President Trump took office about this sort of distrust, about this uneasiness as they do their work. And so perhaps because, again, they've been exposed in a way that is new with, you know, damning details and explicit writing, mm-hmm. especially from Bob Woodward, mm-hmm. it's different. And there is this solidarity.
Yeah.
But, that is the message. That is her message. And You know, frankly, Kellyanne Conway is excellent at her job, and she determines what the message is going to be, and she relays it very well. And she, if you watch her carefully in these interviews, hits the same points over and over.
Right, exactly.
Until you believe her.
Well, Josh Gerstein, let me just jump in here, Ouija, if I may. Josh Gerstein, I mean, Ouija's right to point out that Bob Woodward's book also, we had excerpts of it last week. It's officially released tomorrow, I believe. And you know, Woodward makes me think of course, you know, how much stock should we put in all of these denials that are coming from various administration officials? Because, of course, Mark Felt actively denied that he was Deep Throat for decades.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't put a lot of stock in the denials. I mean, I was struck in the Kellyanne Conway interview by a couple of things. One is she said that the media was obsessed with this. But it's pretty clear if you look at President Trump's Twitter feed, he's fairly obsessed both with the Woodward book and with the anonymous op-ed. I don't think you have to look to the media to find that level of obsession. I mean, it seemed to me some of the tweets coming out through the day on Monday suggested that, you know, he may be proving some of the points that are made in Woodward's book about his preoccupation with criticism and his inability to focus on some of the critical issues because he's diverted by everything everybody says about him in any context. And the other thing I was struck by is while she said in that clip that you guys used that the staff has tightened up and gotten closer and people who don't usually work together are working together. I don't know if I frankly believe all that. She went on to say that it might be the case that having big meetings is not a good idea and they need to have smaller meetings. And, you know, this is one of the concerns I think people, even those who agree with this op-ed, have, which is it could ultimately be counterproductive. I mean, if the concern is that the president needs to be exposed to more ideas and some of his tendencies need to be dampened out by running them through a process where his staff gets to buff off the often very rough edges, if there are fewer staffers involved, if there are fewer meetings, if things happen more quickly and fewer people get into this soup pot, then, you know, that could be an even more extreme and perhaps a more dangerous situation than the one the author of the op-ed described. So a lot of people are concerned that maybe the reaction could be the opposite of whatever this op-ed writer may have intended.
Okay, so Aaron Blake, pick up on that, because I'm also seeing, by the way, that just today on NBC's Today Show, Bob Woodward was saying that Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and White House Chief of Staff John Kelly are, quote, not telling the truth when they deny making disparaging statements about the president that Woodward has attributed to them in his book Fear. Woodward saying these are political statements to protect their jobs. Aaron, what do you think?
A really remarkable statement, I thought, not just because the nature of the disclosures, but also the two men who he's talking about and
right.
I would argue essentially calling liars in this case are military generals. These are people, especially in the case of James Mattis, who have largely been above the fray because of their history, because of their service. This to me sounds like Woodward making very clear that he is not going to have his book trashed by the president or his fellow White House inhabitants. He feels very strongly about his meticulousness, which he is known for. He talks in that same interview on the Today Show about how each of these events is described not just broadly, but also by when it happened, the time of day it happened, who was present in those meetings. I think there's a temptation to look at this and think, oh, it's another Michael Wolff book. This includes significantly more detail, and Bob Woodward is apparently not going to take this criticism sitting down, which I think is a difficult prospect for the White House to deal with.
Yeah. Ouija Jang, we have a comment here from a listener, Neil Blanchard, who says, we need to talk more about what the op-ed said, about what is reported in Bob Woodward's book. And I think Neil's making a good point, because we can talk about the denials and the reaction from members of the administration for a long time. But the core question is, we have two sources here, a book and an op-ed, that are detailing, again, what we've discussed has been reported for some time by a number of news outlets, but of a White House that doesn't seem to be functioning very well and the dangers that could pose, you know, for the White House, for the presidency, and for the government as a whole.
Right. I think when the op-ed dropped, of course, it set Washington into a frenzy. There was this guessing game that continues, but you know, whether it was President Trump or his senior officials, the focus, and you're exactly right, and so is that listener, was identifying who the writer is. However, you know, the president is lending some credibility to the writer just because he is so obsessed and fixated with finding out who the person is within his own administration. You know, even though he has said that, you know, the op-ed is untrue and paints a false narrative, and, you know, as his evidence, he points to all the successes he has had. You know, we really haven't heard so much about the content as we have on who this person is, what should happen to this person if they are ultimately caught. And it seems that that is what the president is more concerned about rather than, you know, what the op-ed says.
Yeah.
And so I think that is a problem. And going forward this week, you know, I think that that will shift.
Yeah.
And they'll have to start answering questions about how this president behaves and, you know, give more specifics about these meetings and these so-called, you know, view differences in view that the president actually appreciates. You know, mm-hmm. that is also part of the message, that he actually wants different opinions. He appreciates them, and he would never try to belittle anybody who opposes him, which is the complete opposite of what we have seen. What we have seen is when, you know, somebody disagrees with the president, whether it's a member of his staff, a member of the media, et cetera, you know, he is unhappy. So you're right. I think that, you know, we need to change the focus and start thinking about more of what the content is of the op-ed. And I should mention that Woodward himself actually criticized the New York Times op-ed for its lack of detail and for not having specific instances that can bolster the big claim.
Right. Well, but the you know, on the other hand, there are specific instances definitely shot through Bob Woodward's book. The president, you know, still today tweeting about this, putting out a tweet saying the economy is so good, perhaps the best in our country's history. The Democrats are flailing and lying like crazy. Phony books, articles, and TV hits like no other Paul has had to endure, and they are losing big, very dishonest people. That tweet from President Donald Trump today. We're going to talk about what effect all of this may have on the midterms that are just, you know what, just under 2 months away now. And we'll do that when we pick up this conversation after the break. Josh Gerstein is with us. He's senior White House reporter for Politico. Weijia Jiang joins us. She's White House correspondent for CBS News. Aaron Blake is also with us. He's senior political reporter at The Washington Post. And we want to hear from you. What do you have your eye on regarding the news this week? What effect do you think all the tension and chaos in the White House is having on the country, on the government, and could have on the midterms? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. States and MLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about what might happen in this week coming up in the news, because it seems as if every week brings a lot of big news. I'm joined today by Josh Gerstein. He's senior White House reporter for Politico. Weijia Jiang is also with us. She's White House correspondent for CBS News. And Aaron Blake joins us as well, senior political reporter at The Washington Post. And I just want to play a quick bit of tape here. This is from Saturday, Anaheim, California. President Barack Obama told the crowd there that in times of great uncertainty, some politicians, in Obama's words, seek to divide people, and that leads to more problems.
It's always tempting for politicians, for their own gain, and for people in power, to try to see if they can divide people.
scapegoat folks, turn them on each other. Because when that happens, you get gridlock and government doesn't work and people get cynical and they decide not to participate.
President Barack Obama in California on Saturday. And of course, Obama is trying to turn out Democratic votes in the midterm elections coming up here. Let's take a quick call. Kathleen is calling from Amesville, Ohio. You're on the air, Kathleen.
Hi. You know, I am amazed by, I mean, I can't stand Trump, never could, would have never voted for him in a trillion years. However, I do get tired of, I couldn't stand the way the right-wing media and our reps, you know, Republican reps, just, you know, blocked everything Obama was trying to do. And now I'm really sick of the left-wing media, Matt Al and Joy Reid, and I mean, I love them on so many issues, but they just, you turn on MSNBC and it's just anti-Trump, anti-Trump, anti-Trump. And then I question their unbridled adoration of Bob Woodward, groupthink Woodward, who went along with the run-up to the invasion of Iraq and also said that the plame outing was much ado about nothing. Uh-huh. Those were his words verbatim, as well as the New York Times, who, with these anonymous sources, come on, they had Judy blanking, I was blanking, Wright Miller, put one article after another about WMDs in Iraq. So I don't trust Woodward or the New York Times, especially in regard to anonymous sources.
Well, Kathleen, let me pick it up from there because I appreciate your thought, and I want to turn to Aaron Blake, senior political reporter at The Washington Post. What do you think about Kathleen's doubt regarding Bob Woodward especially?
You know, any time you write a book like this, which is based upon almost universally interviews conducted on what's called deep background, which is basically, you know, nobody is going to be quoted by name, but there are direct quotes. You know, that's the drawback of it. You get the inside information.
Aaron, you still with us? Oh, looks like we dropped, lost his line. We're going to pick that up as soon as we can. Josh Gerstein, let me turn to you here. I mean, one thing that Bob Woodward has said is that he recorded all the conversations he had with his sources and has transcripts of them. He's, of course, still not going to identify whose sources were, but confident enough to have lots of supporting material for what he's put in his book.
Yeah, I mean, I'm confident that the bulk of what's in the book is accurate, mainly for the reason that Ouija was talking about earlier, which is there's such a broad consistency in the stories that we're hearing from various people in various news outlets. The notion that every news outlet is fabricating all the stories that they're making up about the Trump White House seems to me to border on insane. Now, one can question whether any specific anecdote or story is true. And as Aaron was getting at, one of the difficulties or challenges with this type of sourcing is Bob Woodward is recreating anecdotes and events that took place that he was not present at.
Right.
And then when it's presented in a story, it's often not, or rather in the book, it's not in typical journalistic form. It doesn't say four people present or four people who've talked to senior officials or who are senior officials say. It simply says this happened. There was a meeting on this date. And, you know, General Mattis strode into the room and said, you can't do this in North Korea, Mr. President. And so there's a narrative style there that tends to make these books more interesting to read, yeah, but sometimes obscures a little bit what the sourcing is and what some of the vagaries in the sourcing may be. And the other thing I think you do have to wonder about sometimes with these types of accounts is whether some of the stories may be self-serving. You know, if indeed it is the case that some of the individuals who say they talk back to President Trump are actually the sources for this book, as seems likely, are they exaggerating the degree to which they confronted the president?
Yeah.
I mean, you have to take all those things into account.
Okay, so I want to push ahead here a little bit because, you know, what I really want to dig into with the three of you, and it looks like we have Aaron back as well, is what effect or why this matters in districts around the country and in states around the country. Because, of course, we have a midterm election coming up. You know, historically, they've been seen as the referendum on the president or the party in power. And we have a comment here from on our website, onpointradio.org, and Steph looking to the race between Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke in Texas, saying that Politico reported Sunday Texas's elected officials sent, quote, urgent warnings to the White House that Cruz is in danger of losing. And Josh, let me just kind of pick up here with you, because Mick Mulvaney is also being quoted as suggesting that Republicans might fare better in the midterms if they could, quote, subtract the president's persona from voters' minds. So how much, you know, what effect is this having on what could be a major turning point with this midterm election coming up?
Well, overall, the president's lack of popularity, I think, is having a pretty dramatic effect. And he's been a very polarizing figure. There's no question that just his presence on the political scene has led to an incredible level of activism and activation on the liberal side of the spectrum, even in places like Texas, where liberals have struggled for a long, long time to put together anything that would get them some sort of political power. But, you know, when it comes down to it, in the final analysis in these individual races, how much the president will weigh on them, I don't know. I'm not sure things like the Woodward book or the anonymous op-ed are likely in and of themselves to play a huge role. I think a lot of the Republicans who are potential voters for Republican candidates, if they're really troubled by those things to the point they're going to take it out in races where the president himself is not on the ballot, my guess is those people have peeled off already. So
yeah,
it becomes sort of a question of what happens to folks at the margins and how much do swing voters care about some of these issues and will it cause them to turn out? And will it also cause some Republicans perhaps to just stay home because they're kind of sickened by the spectacle of the whole thing?
Right. I mentioned Mick Mulvaney. And he even noted that he thinks that the main challenge that Ted Cruz might have in Texas isn't necessarily the president of the United States, but in Mulvaney's words, or actually he didn't actually mention Ted Cruz specifically, but said that there might be a charm deficit amongst one of the candidates in the Texas Senate race this year. Weijia, let me just turn back to you here, because there's also the perennial issue. We were talking about sort of enthusiasm and potential turnout. I'm looking here at some numbers. The Democratic National Committee has raised, what, $116 million? Through the end of July. Compare that with the almost $230 million raised by the Republicans. So even if there's a lot of enthusiasm amongst Democrats, there's a infrastructure and funding gap, perhaps, that they still have with the GOP. And will that matter more when it comes to races district by district?
Well, sure. Money always matters in every race. But I think, you know, even though it's not new that we're seeing, you know, during a year you know, when there is a midterm election, so many different races at stake. What's different is who is in charge. And I've seen just recently, you know, in Montana, how these explosive editorials and books are impacting the president's performance when he is supposed to be stumping for those congressional candidates. It's a major distraction, even more than usual. Look, it's not new for the president to go off script, but I can tell you at the last rally I was at, he had to defend his own competence. So here he is reassuring supporters that I'm competent. I'm pretty competent, right? And I thought that was remarkable that a sitting president has to get on stage and tell his supporters and his base that he is, in fact, fit for the job. And also, you know, whether you know, his vote.
I mean, was he doing it rhetorically, though? Because that's often a tone that he strikes in these rallies as well.
Well, he was, you know, this was when he was specifically talking about, you know, the bad books about him, about the New York Times op-ed, which he spent a lot of time discussing at this particular rally. And I think more important than that, aside from, you know, the writing about him, he, for the first time that I can remember, linked the midterm elections to the possibility of his own impeachment hearings. And he said, you know, in this election, you are not just voting for a candidate, you are voting for which party controls Congress, and then goes on to say that the Democrats want to impeach me. And so, you know, that is also extraordinary that he is urging voters to get to the polls, because if not, he's acknowledging the fact that impeachment hearings could be a possibility.
Well, let's take a call here. Tony is calling from Macomb, Michigan. You're on the air, Tony.
Hi, how are you guys doing? Yeah, my question and thought is I kind of agreed with the Ohio caller, other than the point that I'm fully supporting Trump. I voted for him. I hope he makes it to 2020. But I'm just wondering, when are you guys going to talk about the good stuff that's going on in the country? You have the lowest black unemployment. You have the lowest unemployment rates. You have the economy is booming at what, over 4% GDP? And all you guys talk about is, oh my gosh, if it wasn't Stormy Daniels, it's some Trump tweet. But you know what? He's doing exactly why I voted for him. And everybody that I know that voted for him still loves him.
Tony, thank you so much for your call. And Aaron Blake, let me turn that to you because, you know, Tony isn't the only person thinking this. I'm seeing House Speaker Paul Ryan telling reporters late last week that what he concerns with himself is are the results of government, and the results of this government are good results. What do you think, Aaron?
Yeah, I mean, imagine a world in which we didn't have a former lawyer for the president basically accusing him of being an unindicted co-conspirator in a campaign finance crime. Imagine a presidency in which we didn't have the constant tweeting and controversy stoking, the culture wars that the president has very enthusiastically engaged in. Unemployment is below 4%. The stock market has risen 50% in his first 2 years in office. By all accounts, this should be a cakewalk for Republicans, at least as far as holding power in Congress. But instead, we have a situation in which it's imperiled because there is concern. There is a significant amount of concern about what's going on in the White House. And I think that there are lots of Republican strategists right now who take the point that the caller made and think, what if the president could just tone it down for a little while? What if we could just set this aside for a little while and have this be a referendum on the economy? Because that would be a very good winning campaign message for Republicans right now.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, Tony, our caller, was talking about how he sees lots of successes with President Trump in the White House and wondering why people aren't talking about that enough. But on the other hand, there are some Republicans who are doing seemingly continuous soul searching about where their party finds itself. Here's Republican Ben Sasse of Nebraska telling CNN's Jake Tapper that he thinks about leaving his party, quote, every morning. And in this clip, you'll hear him going after both Republicans and Democrats in Congress.
There's massive stuff happening in America, and these parties are really pretty content to do 24-hour news cycles screaming at each other. The main thing that the Democrats are for is being anti-Republican and anti-Trump, and the main thing Republicans are for is being anti-Democrat and anti-CNN, and neither of these things are really worth getting out of bed in the morning for.
That's Republican Ben Sasse of Nebraska. Josh Gerstein, respond to what you heard Sasse there say. I mean, he's been saying these things for a long time, but nevertheless, he remains a Republican and supports, you know, efforts, Republican efforts in Congress and, you know, led by President Trump.
Right. I mean, you've seen a lot of criticism of figures like Sasse, Jeff Flake, for example, because while they will deliver criticism, Bob Corker would be another one in the Senate. These are people who have talked back to the president, both publicly, privately, have said things that he finds rather annoying and have criticized the way in which he conducts himself. They haven't really made significant attempts to stymie the president's policies, with one possible exception, which is in the area of trade, where there have been some efforts by Congress to push back a little bit against some of the things the president has done on that front. On pretty much every other front, there's been no effort to resist or investigate. I think that's what's a little bit mystifying to some Democrats is why some of the committees in Congress, when you have various scandals that have arisen during this administration, have essentially whistled past the graveyard and paid no attention to what's going on, whereas it seems like under some previous Congresses, including some maybe where it was of the same party, you would have had at least going through the motions of some investigation of some of these issues that have arisen about the White House, about various nominees and scandals in different departments such as the EPA and
yeah.
So forth. So it's surprising, I think, not to see a little bit more activism from Congress. But like Sasse says, some of it is driven by the natural polarization that we're seeing in the environment at the moment and by the cable TV news cycle.
Yeah. Well, since you mentioned Senator Jeff Flake, I mean, he's called the party's he's called it a, quote, Faustian bargain that he sees the GOP having made with President Trump, but that bargain is, you know, to be specific, it's brought tax cuts, a wave of confirmations for judges in the lower courts. And if Kavanaugh gets confirmed, it could have a major shift in the Supreme Court as well. And I'm saying here that Reuters is reporting that Republicans in the House are planning to unveil another round of potential tax cuts this week in order to draw, you know, further contrast between themselves and Democrats ahead of the midterms. Weijia, your quick thought here about, you know, the Faustian bargain and whether or not it doesn't really matter because congressional Republicans are getting things done.
Well, I think that, you know, the mistake is that people will argue it's mutually exclusive, that you can't have a chaotic White House and also have all these achievements. And that's not true. As you point out, as the caller points out, you can. And this is not new, starting from when I remember being on the campaign trail, when it was very apparent that Donald Trump was going to be the Republican nominee. I think there was this first shock because of who he was as a candidate and who he remains as the president. But then this serious effort to get behind him in this sort of acceptance and acknowledgement that this is going to happen, whether we like it or not, because there was so much resistance from other members of the Republican Party to support President Trump, candidate Trump. And now they see that, you know, he does hold a lot of power. He does have a lot of support among his base. And so I think in some sense, you know, the GOP is afraid to be too vocal against him, including all the congressional members of Congress, because they understand the effect that President Trump has.
Well, you're listening to Weijia Jiang. She's White House correspondent for CBS News. Josh Gerstein is also with us, senior White House reporter for Politico. And Aaron Blake, senior political reporter at The Washington Post. We're talking about what news might this week hold. Definitely want to hear from you about what you care about. We'll take a bunch of calls when we come back from the break and also talk about George Papadopoulos' sentencing and Paul Manafort's second trial coming up. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate.
Corporate.
Income.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the news that we may have to grapple with this week, including some pretty interesting events coming up, such as the jury selection in Paul Manafort's second trial. I'm joined today by Josh Gerstein. He's senior White House reporter for Politico. He also covers justice and national security. Weijia Jiang also joins us today. She's White House correspondent for CBS News. And Aaron Blake, senior political reporter at The Washington Post. Josh, Weijia, and Aaron, if I may, we got a lot of callers who want to join us, so let's just hear from a bunch of them if we can. Anne Marie is calling from Scituate, Rhode Island. You're on the air, Anne Marie.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for taking my call. My comment is, after your caller, Tony, talked about all the good things Trump has done, I feel that there is not enough coverage given to all the terrible things that have happened in these months since he's been elected. The Consumer Protection Bureau is weakened. From the tax cut for the wealthy, which is going to fall on our grandchildren to pay for this. The federal workers got an increase in pay, and he canceled it.
Right, the president froze
saying
that.
The budget could not afford it. The EPA, the things he's doing to the environment, saying he doesn't believe in climate change, but yet in Scotland he wants the government to pay for a wall to protect his golf course from rising seas.
So, Anne-Marie, are you saying that perhaps there's too much focus on what the president says through Twitter, for example, and not enough on actions that his administration is actually taking?
Yes, yes. I really feel that the people that love him just they're tuning out all of this, his actions, because they loved him like
right.
that.
Well, Anne-Marie, let me take that back from you. I really appreciate it. That's Anne-Marie calling from Scituate, Rhode Island. Let's go to Buffalo, New York now, where Laura is calling. And Laura, do you think that the people who are supporting Trump, Anne-Marie just said that she feels like they're tuning out the president's actual actions and not paying attention to that? What do you think?
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. I think the base of the president is predominantly religious people, whether they're evangelicals or Christians or what, and they're used to persecution of their leaders. So I don't think there's a lot of wavering in what the president is doing. I think taking care of veterans and the economy and jobs is a little higher than some of these other achievements, but I have faith that he is going to achieve everything that he says he wants to achieve, and I'm not backing down from my support. Thank you.
Laura, thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Martha, who's calling from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Martha, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I think our president obviously has an extreme inferiority complex, and he lacks confidence in himself by the way he responds and the way he automatically reacts. All the time that he spends tweeting, can he not just take hold of our government and our country and see what's happening? But then in hindsight of all of this, I think the American public is stepping up. We're paying attention to our government and what they're doing and what's happening more than ever before, rather than just sitting back. We have everything politically seems to be upset, but that is not bad. They're the good guys are out there. Okay, good right. guys, step up. We're listening.
Martha, thank you so much for your call, Martha. That was Martha from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Aaron Blake, we just heard from, you know, a number of different perspectives here. It seems as if, I suppose, I'm not sure, you know, people who call into a wonderful show like this, as wonderful as maybe are, if that's necessarily a representative sample of America. But what do you hear in all those voices from those callers that we just heard?
Well, I actually thought we got a pretty good mix of them we have over the last 20 minutes or so here. You know, I think the one takeaway I have from those phone calls is everybody has different perceptions of what actually matters in this presidency. We had a more liberal caller who thought that the president was undoing environmental regulations and things like that. He thought that the actual output of this administration was really bad. Another person thought that the successes that were being forged on a policy level were being ignored. They thought that was an undercovered story.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have people who are, of course, upset with all the controversy and the tweeting and everything. This has been a presidency which has basically allowed everybody to choose their own adventure. The president does so many different things that he provides an explanation that everybody is going to be happy with eventually, who supports him at least. And there is so much going on right now that it's easy to pick out and choose the things that you like. It's easy to pick out and choose the things that you don't like. And the result of all of that has been a actually remarkably steady presidency from the standpoint of his approval rating, which
right.
has been hovering around 40%. So through all of this, through all the things that have been unprecedented and new in American politics over the last couple of years, we're basically at the position which we started at the beginning of his presidency. And I think that there's really no sign that that's going to change anytime soon.
Mm. Now, before folks get mad at me for saying that the callers we heard weren't representative of America. We've got listeners all over the country. I don't want people to think that I'm not saying that. I'm just, my educational background's in science, and sometimes I just have to think that, like, folks who call in are perhaps, they're a self-selecting population of people who really want to speak. So that's all I'm trying to say here. But let's turn now and talk about a couple of other issues, political stories that do deserve our attention as well. One of them has to do with former Trump campaign advisor George Papadopoulos. He was sentenced on Friday to 14 days in jail as part of special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. And on Sunday on ABC This Week, they aired an interview with Papadopoulos, and he described a meeting with then candidate Donald Trump, also then Senator Jeff Sessions and others during the campaign, in which Papadopoulos told them, he says, he could arrange a meeting between Trump and Russian President Putin.
The reaction, of course, was mixed. There were many people in that room that came from conservative think tanks, including the Heritage Foundation, who, you know, nodded in disapproval. The candidate Trump at the time nodded at me. I don't think he was committed either way. He was open to the idea. And he deferred, of course, to then senior Senator Jeff Sessions, who I remember being quite enthusiastic.
Weijia Jiang, so that 14-day sentence that Papadopoulos got as a result of his cooperation with Robert Mueller's investigation, is that significant or not? What does it tell us?
Well, it tells us what happens when you cooperate and when you choose to, you know, I don't try to use this word a lot, but flip, you know, because 14 days is not substantial compared to what he could have gotten. And I think it sends a message, perhaps, most specifically to Paul Manafort, who has been sentenced or has been convicted and is now awaiting his fate. And I think, you know, as the investigation continues and as we see more witnesses and more people indicted, you know, that is something that will be considered. But, you know, in terms of the content of what he said during that interview, I think it was, you know, really interesting, because what we have to ask is, what if that were true? Mm-hmm. What if the president did, in fact, nod? You know, that still, is that enough to, you know, show that there was evidence of collusion between the then-candidate Trump and Russia? I mean, I don't think we get there. And I think that's, you know, the question that we are all waiting for to see. And so he himself was very careful to say, I don't know exactly what will happen at the end of the investigation, but perhaps my testimony helped move that forward. And so I think, you know, all these bits and pieces, even though they're coming out slowly, are important, including his sentencing and what it might say. Yeah. In terms of the broader investigation.
Well, so Josh,
and another thing.
Oh, go ahead.
If I could, Magna,
yeah.
Just off that Papadopoulos interview, the president's reaction was one thing. The other thing here is what Attorney General Jeff Sessions has said about this in congressional testimony. He has talked about how he was unenthusiastic about that idea, how he pretty much just kind of begged off Papadopoulos when he suggested the Putin meeting. So this opens the idea of whether the Attorney General of the United States was being honest, yet again, by the way, when talking about Russian relations during the 2016 campaign. This is not a new thing here. The Sessions' comments have been scrutinized before because it seemed like he slow-rolled the relationship between the two of them. So I expect this is something that he's going to be asked about if and when he does come back to Congress and talk on in a hearing setting.
Okay, it's interesting. Josh Gerstein, pick up on that. And also, I just want to note that, you know, as Weijia pointed out, that 14-day sentence that Papadopoulos got and being interpreted as, well, you know, that's the reward that you get for cooperating with the special counsel. But I do note that there are some Republicans who are saying, well, since he only got a 14-day sentence, you know, maybe what he had to offer wasn't any kind of big deal. I mean, that might be, you know, spin on from that side. But what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think the president himself said that in a tweet that that, you know, we've got 14 days, a sentence for $28 million, suggesting that it shows what a joke the whole Mueller investigation and prosecution are. Of course, that ignores the 8 felony counts that Manafort was convicted on and a bunch of other things. But you can see, if you're just looking for talking points to dismiss the investigation, how this might seem like a slap on the wrist and something that, you know, a local, you know, people have probably gotten 14 days for jaywalking before. So this does seem like a relatively minor sentence, if that's all Mueller's going to come up with. The thing I was struck by at the sentencing hearing was that Papadopoulos really had a chance to either align himself with the White House and the president and the critics of this investigation, or with the investigators and with Mueller and with those who are trying to take the Russia probe seriously. His wife had suggested in advance of the hearing that he should try to reverse his plea, change his lawyers, suggest that the FBI set him up, work towards a pardon from President Trump, and suggest that, you know, he was basically, you know, put in this position as a result of some kind of government misconduct. I thought it was interesting, even though his wife was sitting right behind him in court, his lawyers did precisely the opposite. In fact, they attacked President Trump in the courtroom and said that it was Trump's attitude of calling this investigation fake news and a witch hunt that led Papadopoulos to think that he should be uncooperative with the FBI in the first instance and lie or mislead about his contacts with some of the pro-Russian figures involved in this whole affair. So it was an interesting moment where he had to make a decision. He decided, as I said, to align himself with the investigators, and that saved him at least a few more weeks in prison than he would have gotten otherwise. Mm. Ultimately, if it costs him a pardon or something, we'll probably know that at some point down the road.
Let's take one more call here. Joe is calling from Natick, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Joe.
Hi, Magna. I'm from the Midwest, from Missouri, and when I was a kid, I can recall we had lots of crazy thunderstorms, and the way I dealt with it as a child was I would put my head under a pillow and sing to myself to drown it out. This is what I believe Trump supporters do with this president. He came in there saying he was going to drain the swamp. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, pretty much everybody around this individual that was part of his campaign in his circle or on the just barely out of the circle has been charged, pleaded guilty, or is indicted, or heading to court.
Well, to be exact, not pretty much everyone, but key people, yes.
Yes. Well, I mean, please, let's just compare that to any president in my lifetime, and I'm 60 years old. This is a criminal organization. It's absurd. If this was a Democrat or any other party, the Republicans and these mouth breathers that support him would be up in arms screaming bloody murder.
Joe, I'm going to take it back from you there. I hear your passion about where we are now, although I think perhaps a lot of people might object to your characterization of some of the president's supporters there. Aaron Blake, I mean, respond to that, though. I think Joe looks at the number of people who have either been found guilty. I mean, Paul Manafort in his first trial, he's got another one coming up, or have pleaded guilty. It is a remarkable number, nonetheless.
It really is. And I'm going back to what a previous caller said, which was that we were ignoring all of the successes of the Trump administration. I also think to some degree we get desensitized to exactly how unprecedented all of this is because it all seems familiar now 20 months into the presidency. It is remarkable that all of these figures that are very senior in the president's campaign, people who even served in the White House, if you're including Michael Flynn in that, have gotten themselves in legal trouble. That is not something that has real precedent in American politics. I think the president's supporters certainly find themselves willing to give the benefit of the doubt on a lot of this stuff. They say, well, as long as there's no collusion, nothing happened here. Well, there's a lot of other stuff that happened here, whether or not there was a phone call or an alliance between the Trump campaign and Russia. There is an exceptional amount of false statements that are being made, financial crimes by people that the president hired. So we can all look at this and justify our own positions about how the president is conducting himself as an actual president versus all the controversy that surrounds him. But the fact is we are in very uncharted territory here. We don't know the full extent of everything that's happening, and it could get much worse from here.
Yeah. Weijia Jiang, we've just got about 40 seconds to go here. I didn't get to a caller who said, we may be worrying about storms in Washington, but we've actually got an actual hurricane headed towards the East Coast. And, you know, is the government functioning enough to be able to help people who might need it very soon?
Yes. I mean, in short, yes. Certainly the agencies that have to do that are they, you know, and the president always acknowledges when there's a state of emergency and supports those states. I think as far as the hurricane that is continuing to brew at the White House, I don't know what the remedy for that is. And I just, I think Aaron's absolutely right. People have chosen their own adventure and getting them to change course is nearly impossible.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We may be choosing our own adventure, but the fact is we are all in this adventure together. Weijia Jiang, White House correspondent for CBS News, joining us from Washington. Really great to talk with you, Weijia. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Aaron Blake, senior political reporter at The Washington Post. Aaron, delightful to talk to you. Thank you as well.
Thank you, Magna.
And Josh Gerstein, senior White House reporter for Politico. He also covers justice and national security as well. Josh, thank you as always.
Thanks, Magna.
Keep those comments coming. We're at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.